Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Hello!
Oh, we're on. Come on.
I'm not actually supposed to be on my own, but Kevin
Sorry.
And Joe, here
Sorry.
We go!
Thought that was a drill.
This might be a theme
you
for
want me too?
Yes.
This might
yeah.
be a Yay!
I don't know why I'm here, this, honest to God.
This might actually be a theme for the night because, as JP mentioned there in the little bit there, that was very up to the minute. Storm Doris nearly ruined this show today. Yeah. Poor Tommy Rooney, who is the guest booker in chief for these things, this morning he had a full head of hair. Now he's kind of.
He's come up trumps, he's a bit Paul O'Connell. Yeah.
But ultimately, it's all worked out because both Ryanair and Aer Lingus have managed to get our guests to Dublin Airport, which is where they are at the moment. So it's just. It's going to be 45 minutes of filler from Kevin Kilbane. Kevin, what's your opinion on that? What do you think about the new head height tackle rule in rugby? Seriously, though, you've been to the Olympia with the Ireland team before. I think you came to see a special performance of Mrs. Brown's boys.
Yeah, last time I was here, I was watching Alabama Shake, so I was in the. I was actually stood up there. So, but I had seen Mrs. Brown boys sat up in the posh seats up here. Yeah.
Hipster.
Yeah.
The Alabama Shakes.
Yeah.
One of the things that we did want to ask you, though, because obviously, you know, you've played like 600 times for Ireland. First time, I think, ever in our history that you're not the most capped person on stage.
Yeah, I know.
So that's
I've got to live with that, haven't I?
A massive bit blow to your ego. But do you get nervous? Do you still get nervous about stuff? Like, does, you know, the fact that there are 1,200...
It's more the audience, yeah.
People it's staring up to you going...
The lads that come on and test me knowledge tonight, yeah. That's what I'm nervous about tonight, yeah. Yeah. It's good that it's nice.
Did you really, though? Seriously, because we're going to talk to the lads
during
a little bit.
Yeah, well, I remember, certainly for... international debut, very, very nervous, and I had a stinker on my international debuts. But I did, yeah, particularly when you're younger. The more experience you get, the easier I used to find it, yeah.
There was a piece in the Mark Kennedy interview, which everybody should download because it's absolutely amazing, where you went, oh yeah, I played for the senior team and then didn't play for ages afterwards. I had to go back to the under 21 team. You didn't tell us that.
Yeah,
it was that bad, you got dropped.
That, for about 2 years, yeah. 2 years. Yeah, it was that bad, yeah, it was. It was, but that's how it is, that's what it is. That's a learning curve, isn't it?
And, yeah. And so the second time, 2 years later, were the nerves gone?
No, not really. I think the second time, my second debut, it was my home debut actually, it was against Argentina, and I had another stinker. So, yeah, so it got better. It got a little bit better.
Right,
anyway,
at the 50th cap, you stopped having stinkers, is that it?
Yeah.
All right, if anybody wants to get in touch with us tonight, you know the drill. You can text us here on 53106, or you can hit us up on Twitter, or also obviously on facebook.com/offtheball. We are here with thanks to Heineken Rugby Club, which allows fans to get more from the game. If you sign up, you'll get exclusive benefits, such as match tickets, exclusive event invites, discounts with Ireland's top brands, and more. Join at HeinekenRugbyClub.com. Now, on the radio, you might not have noticed this, but we have giant goalposts on the stage, which are looming large. It's like a gun in a Chekhov play. It's going to be the third act before we get to use that. Hey, we're a clever crowd. You got it.
What are we doing with the goalpost, Ger?
Well, so...
Demonstration.
Yeah, Kevin's going to jump over it. And Donegal Callan's going to catch him. It's an Adrian Barry special. We'll reveal all a little bit later on. There's going to be drop goals and stuff like that. But So, look, we're here to have a good time. We're here to tell some pretty mean stories. There's a giant green chair in the back as well. It'll become apparent what that's for. We've got a great quiz lined up. Ireland are playing France this weekend. We're going to kill the French, right? I'm not so sure. Let's get out some people who have actually killed the French. Please welcome our first two guests. It's Keith Wood and Brian O'Driscoll. Welcome. So before we get started, there's a little very important thing that we have to clear up here. Early February, somebody tweeted at Austin Healy, cool story, Austin. What do you think of this? And it was the story that you've both told us separately on this show about you kicking the shit out of him on the Lions tour. And he was like, complete after-dinner fabrication, was what he said. I'm not saying he's calling you a liar, but, you know.
I hadn't had my dinner at that stage, but I will say one of my friends sent me a text about it, and... the following morning, I rang Draco. I said, Draco, I know we talk about concussion protocols. I don't think I embellished that story. You know, I think that's a pretty... I was actually really doubting myself. I said, that is true, isn't it?
Well, that story is definitely true, that he called me.
I like it.
No, it's the one story that absolutely kills Austin.
Yeah.
And his retort when it's brought up is usually, oh, let's arrange a charity rematch then and I'll box the head off you. which is an answer in itself, because he has a reason to get one back on me.
Yeah,
so,
it clearly happens.
Austin is incredibly confident, some might say cocky, but he literally has no comeback, so his latest comeback is just to completely refute
lie,
it ever
yeah.
happened.
Fake news, I think, is the strategy he's gone for. But hang on a second, so he did news. Actually offer you a rematch. Can we sort that out? Like, I mean, you take that, right? Come on, you'd raise loads of money and you'd kill him again.
Sure. The first part of that, the story as we tell it is true. I couldn't believe he decided to quit. Austin is tough. No, he was daft and very cocky the same day, and he was certain that he would win, that he'd beat up this kid. Like, you were 21 or 22 at the time. Yeah, I'd be slow to have an old go at Austin. You'd always want to kind of beat him up, you know. Yeah, but I'd pay money to see a rematch of that, I have to say.
The beauty of tonight is we get Raj on eventually. We feel he's off the runway now.
Yeah, he's in passport control.
It was his honour you stepped in to defend. So I'm looking forward to hearing what he was thinking as you were punching the head off Austin Healey on his behalf.
I don't know.
I love that man.
It was... I look back, it was possibly stupidity. I was lucky that it ended up the way it did, but I'm like Woody says, I wouldn't be in a rush to have another go. Like, Austin is pretty fit and agile, and I was relatively lucky that day, so, you know, I'll just call it quits at 1-0 and gloat for the rest of my days.
That was a Lions tour, which you two shared. You were also on a Lions tour with Dunnock O'Callaghan, who's also somewhere near a runway right now, but we think approaching the building. What was it like being on a Lions tour with Dunnock for 6-7 weeks?
Exhausting. Dunners is married to my cousin Jen, so I know him well through the age groups. We played schools together, played 19s. I have a lot of time for Dunners. He was absolutely...
We should explain for our listeners at home that Dunnock is wearing nothing but black pants this time. I thought he exclusively wore red. And Tommy Bowe seems to be examining the crotch area for some reason. What goes on tour is supposed to stay on tour, but obviously the Infowar sports file were there.
Like
and here he is in the shower. I thought we weren't going to roll these out until a bit later. But
I've never met anyone that liked worshipping the sun more than Dunnock O'Callaghan. But he's, the practical joking thing, he embraced that. I think we saw it. It wasn't a practical or done on purpose in the Leicester game where he had his shorts stripped off him and he had his red underwear showing, and he decided he wasn't given time to change them, so he ran into the line out to try and play on. I love that picture right there. It was cold that day.
When did it?
Was Under Armour not in at this stage? Was there not like something more dignified, or like as opposed to like some granddad trunks that he's wearing there?
Have to be in his lucky pants, because they're not the most beautiful looking things. But
he makes a fortune out of this, though.
Oh, I know. Yeah,
this is like a if you're being cynical, you say it was pre-planned. I need an underwear contract. How do I get one? You just rip off my shorts. There, we split the money.
But speaking of underwear stories, on that 05 Lions tour, yeah. Alistair Campbell was head of PR and communications.
A good move in retrospect?
Yeah, it worked out really well for the whole tour. Okay. It was all about the players, not so much about him. But Alistair, like him or loathe him, if you spend time with him, he's very, very good company. And a lot of the boys from that tour have remained in contact. But remember, we were together a day or two, and we were in Heathrow Airport about to fly out, and I was in having a whiz, and I turned around having heard some shrieks from him, and all I saw was his arse staring back at me with Dunnock O'Callaghan's foot between his legs, standing on his pants as he jocked him having a piss. And And himself and Dunica are the best of friends now. So it went from strength to strength. But yeah, he was Dunica. You had to be careful around him. You never ever had tracksuit bottoms that weren't tied very, very tight around the waistband. You were always open to a jocking.
Given that Ronan O'Gara is not here as well, we can tell some stories about him if you want. You can, I mean, he'll be here to defend himself about 40 minutes, but feel free to use the intervening period to enlighten us.
Will we pick on Raj? Now, that's one of the questions. I remember when he arrived on the scene first, actually between himself and Stringer, do you know when you get things just comfortably wrong? I said, you can't pick these two guys. They're too small. Look at them. They're going to get bloody killed. And we were made to suffer for that for a long time. But Roger's he's angry, isn't he? Isn't he? You know, for
this is his Newbridge Silver era.
I ran at him one day in training, and you know, things get slightly wrong. I dipped my shoulder. I don't know what he was doing, but he ended up on my shoulder, and I had the ball under one arm and kind of Raj over my shoulder. And he was so embarrassed, he started punching me into the face. I got a fit of giggling, actually. He was, but he was like angry all the time, and which was great. Like for a guy who gets slagged off for, you know, not really tackling or not being great defensively, he never shirked any of them. Like he got kicked up and down the field often, and he was still always there at the very end to kick the kicks, which was kind of cool. But yeah, like for, well, you see him when he comes out in a while, he's not particularly big. And he is quite angry.
You know the way Raj would stand up and take it flat in the face, those tackles? Was his technique off? Like, or was there anything he could
dreadful.
Have done?
Dreadful. Like, absolutely dreadful.
So it was small size combined with dreadful technique. Well, careful now, this might be on the taxi.
Well, I couldn't actually understand standing up into it. I mean, I was rubbish at tackling. I tucked in both my arms. I wouldn't last 15 minutes in a game. Every tackle would have been considered a shoulder charge. But I tried to hit them with some weight and force. Rod should just be steamrolled out of the way. But yeah, are you listening on this? He's probably listening in the car. Rod, we're slagging you.
He feels a shiver on his back.
No, but he just didn't. I don't know, like, you played outside him for...
Yeah, I actually got moved into 12 a bit defensively to kind of keep an eye on him. playing against New Zealand, like, I didn't have my hands full at the best of times to be doing that. It's a half a job for him as well. Just make sure if it is crashed in that you double hit.
Just 1 second. Could someone tweet Raj and say, turn on News Talk 106 right now? Carry on.
Yeah, so I had to kind of keep an eye in there. And then, you know, particularly when you have Mananu, it's like, I don't really need to be worrying about him. Like, I have a lot to be worrying about on my own with that Mananu. But then keep an eye inside and then make sure you're pushed out. And they used to, you know, I used to share the workload with Darius every so often because, you know, when Raj was playing 10, teams tend to attack the 10 channel a fair bit.
Yeah.
But yes, he never shirked any challenge. He attempted a huge number of tackles. Completion rate not quite as good as he would have hoped for.
Did you think it was his technique? Was it because he stood up so high, or was he doomed either way?
That storm door or whatever it's called, that would blow him over, you know. it's just physically in an attritional game, it wasn't his strong point.
Right.
We better start talking about some of the things he was good at,
bag him
for the whole show.
You know,
he had some talents.
We were chatting to the lads a little bit earlier on.
Modelling and whatnot.
Yeah, modelling. We just missed that one. But we were chatting to Kevin a little bit earlier on about nerves, and he's got some stuff to say about that. We'll talk to him about it too. But before Ireland games, before big games, was there a point in your career where you did feel nerves, or were you kind of generally like, look, this is...
Actually, with him, he used to sit in front of me in the bus, and as the longer I went in my career... The more people started wearing headphones, and I was never one to. And Woody was the same. We used to have a laugh in the bus on the way to the game. You had some outriders, and you'd take in the atmosphere, particularly at home.
What about Scotland? The outriders good in Scotland?
No, brutal police escort in Scotland. That's for another day. But But I always used to insist that there was at least one or two people that didn't wear headphones, and Rog never did. But I used to get fun out of winding him up because he'd be trying to get his head on for it, and I couldn't do that until I arrived to the ground.
He was very interested in that. In his first autobiography, I was rereading it last night, and the morning of the 06 semi-final, Leinster-Munster, you sent him a text, he said, saying, "Let's go hard at it today." And he wrote back joking, "Yeah, not too hard, you know, ha, ha, ha." Mm. And he said before games he was in agony, he was suffering, he was in pain, and he couldn't believe that you were in the state of mind to send a jokey text like that on the morning of the game. He's like, "I hate this guy, that I'm dying, I can't sleep, I can't eat." And he said, O'Driscoll, joking, laughing, and could turn it on pretty close to kickoff, and he was incredibly jealous of this.
Yeah, that one didn't work out great for me, though, did it? I was always unbelievably relaxed until we got to the ground. There was nervous energy.
Yeah, but you could sleep and eat. Could sleep and eat and all that stuff.
Yeah, but you've had butterflies. You know, bigger games, you'd struggle with your pre-match meal. But for the most part, it was fun, and it was going to be a special day, and playing in front of thousands of people in a green jersey. You know, what's not to get excited about with that? So a lot of my energy would have been nervous energy and trying to have a laugh with people and not be too serious and not play the game in my head too early. I didn't send him a text message before the 09 semi-final. I thought, geez, that worked out very badly, so he's not getting one this time. I'm going to come hard. I'm not going to even tell him about it.
Were you a Roger and O'Driscoll?
I was a little bit of both at the start. I mean, I kind of took it very seriously because we were, you know, in the very early 90s, in 92, and a bit of a kind of crossover. You're sitting on the bench and you're watching other captains and how they would take things and how Ireland were at that particular period of time. I got very nervous at the very start because it was all about the first 5 minutes almost. And actually, the way we played was an awful lot about the first 5 minutes because we couldn't really sustain that for anything longer than that. Well, we could a bit longer, but no, we weren't really... we just weren't geared up for it, for the most part. It then took a period of time, and I would have been a serious enough captain the second I'd be in the changing room. But I wanted a bit of crack, a bit of a laugh on the bus. I didn't want an hour and a half or 2 hours before a game thinking that, God, this is so important. Of course it's important. Everybody knows that. But you wanted to try and chill out a little. And yeah, sometimes you'd be nervous. And some of that would be fear. Some of it would be expectation. Some of it would be a little bit of worry about the team you had. And some of it would have been a little bit of worry about the injuries that you might have yourself.
Did it matter which game? Like, so would you be less nervous playing Italy than you were playing France in the Parc de France or the Stade de France?
They're two great teams for me because I was always afraid of Italy because when I was involved at the start, Ireland were losing against Italy. Italy had a really good team in the mid-90s, and suddenly we're in the ascendancy, and you just didn't want to get back into those days at all. And for fear of not getting your head on as a team and taking something for granted, that would annoy the hell out of me. Playing France, because especially when I started, it was terrifying. And we went through 3 or 4 years where, like, when you think about it, Ireland never won in Parc des Princes. In the whole time that France played there against Ireland, they never won. And we got hockeyed in some matches. And that's soul-destroying. And like it is, with Dricker was there, but 2 years before Dricker arrived on the scene, we had got our act together and we went and played. We lost 18-16, and it was all about staying in the game, getting in the game, staying in the game, not being lost and out of sight after 20 minutes, because Paris in the springtime, the French go ballistic if they get a lead and suddenly it's carnage. So 2 years before Tricot's hat-trick, we nearly got there. And so when we got to that year in 2000, we knew guys that had come on. We had a bit more belief. We weren't as scared, and it was funny. We still won by only one or two points.
Was all nerves reading in the newspaper, watching TV, listening to radio, the hype around the games?
Yeah, You know, I don't know. I not that I don't care about the newspapers, and people say they don't read them. I used to read them.
Yeah.
And I would always say they're either slating you or they're bigging you up too much, and both of them tend to be wrong. And so you want to have a little look at it and say, yeah, well, I want to be right for the game. I want us to do ourselves proud. I want us to win, actually. And it took a while for us to get to that idea where winning was a proper possibility as opposed to a hopeful dream. And once that happened, that's damn sight more fun then, I'll tell you. The nerves are very different when you know you have a great chance of winning and winning and winning and winning.
That's kind of the evolution of the team. That's like the how nervous you get. You actually believe you're going to win. And so it's completely different from, I have a fear of getting hockeyed here.
Yeah, it's a different kind of thing. One of my last games, I don't know if Drico remembers it, we kind of leave our doors open. And I think we were playing Australia maybe, or could have been France. But I think it was Australia in the World Cup. I fell asleep before in my room, and you walked past, the door was open, and just called my name and woke me up. And I'd actually dropped off to sleep. I wasn't tired or anything. I just was pretty chilled. And, you know, it's my last couple of games, and I was that relaxed. I knew we were going to perform well, felt we were in a good place.
I'm thinking that might be the Australia game, because the France game, they were 27-0 up at halftime.
I think you may be right.
Possibly could have been too relaxed before that.
When I think of you and nerves, guilt by association, it's the Lions tour where you're making the speech pre-match, and in the background you can hear Neil Jenkins retching, dry retching.
Yeah, Neil Jenkins retches at every available opportunity. I mean, like for a guy, like you only hear him, there was four or five guys puked in the change room before those ones, but Jenkins was as cool as a cucumber. He kicked... I looked at the game about 2 years ago. I looked back at the games, having not watched them, you know, it's 20 years now, but I hadn't actually watched the games back. And I watched them about 2 years ago. And if you'd asked me, I would have sworn he kicked sort of 15 out of 15. And that he didn't. He missed a good few, but we thought he was going to kick everything. And he banged them over. But he puked twice, three times before every single match. Didn't matter that it was a big game. He'd just get a bit excitable. And... Yian Evans, oh, really? Yian, like every time anybody said anything, Yian either cried or puked.
That's not great, though.
John Hayes loved a bomb. Yeah,
did
loved
he?
It before a game. Yeah.
He loved to cry as well, actually. Yeah.
They had to be really big games. But yeah,
wow.
If there was a heave in the toilet, there was a good chance it was going to be him.
Hayes.
Yeah,
it's tough, isn't it?
Actually, there was an awful stink in our change room, wasn't there?
We were going to get Ronan O'Gara on the phone, but his phone battery has died. So, but I'm sure there's a friendly taxi driver who has the radio on at the moment. So maybe you want to tell Rog, give him a big cheer. They're warning him off on Twitter, but we can't check it now. They're putting in the digs while you're not there, fully expecting a lethal comeback on arrival. Let's talk a little bit about France, obviously, and that kind of those games where 98 they put in a good performance. 2000, obviously, we win that game. Like, apart from your hat-trick, do you remember anything else in the game?
I think we played well. I do remember Gerald Merceron was playing 10 for them, and he had 100% from the kicking tee. So it wasn't a case of them being really poor on the day. I think we outplayed them, but they were still decent, which made it all the more enjoyable. It was, you look back at it now, and the billowing jerseys and you know, defensive systems mightn't have been in place, but I still remember for the time being an incredibly physical test match. And it, you know, I think you look back at the games, you know, on TG Carr, Rugby Bio through the 80s and early 90s, they're still tough games. It might be of a different era at a different time, but rugby's still very hard and physical no matter what time. International yeah. rugby is. It's gotten to a new level now, but everyone's fitter and stronger. So I just remember it being fast, frenetic. We cut them open a good bit. We got lots of line breaks. I was in the right place for a couple of tries. And then, you know, I think it was Humps came on at the end and knocked over the winning penalty. I guess I didn't really realise how much it meant, or the 28-year thing was lost
to me. It's going to happen loads. Yeah.
I suppose that was the naivety of youth.
I remember we kicked a ball deep and they kicked it into touch. It was about 20 minutes, 25 minutes. And I ran, you know, you'd always try and run, get there early so you could take in a big breath, you know. And I ran. I remember going down to pick up the ball, and I said, I'm actually on the point of keeling over. I am so absolutely knackered. And I look back, and the Irish pack were there, and the French weren't. And they were strewn all over the field. And that was the first time I ever felt, yeah, we have them, we've run them. Like, they were so fast the first 20 minutes of that game.
Yeah.
Nearly everything worked for them, but didn't. I think they were 7-3 up or 6-3. I can't even remember if they'd scored a try at the time. But it was the fastest 20 minutes I'd ever played. And I was absolutely knackered. But they were worse. And even then, just watching how we played the game, or, you know, remembering that sense of it, almost daring to believe that you could actually go and do it. And we'd score a try. Draco would score a try. And then he'd score another one, which is nice. But we were never out of sight. And we were in a position, like, we could have lost that game just as easy. So we have a guy who scores a hat-trick. I don't know when the last time it was that there was a hat-trick in the Five or Six Nations from an Irish player. And he scores a hat-trick, and we could have lost the game. And Humps then comes on and bangs it over.
I tell you, the turning point to that game where it would have gotten away from us was Dennis Hickey's tackle on Mark Dalmazzo, where he hunted him down from 25 yards, tackled him, head in front of his knees, split himself open, and he spilled the ball going over the line. Was absolutely exceptional. I think if they had gotten a 7-pointer there, it would have been 10 or 11 ahead.
Yeah.
It would have been the old French UA after that. They would have gotten excited about, you know, the brand that they were playing. I think that was the difference. Him saving that gave us a chance of getting back into the game.
Did he'd been around the camp, Brian had been around the camp for maybe 18 months at that stage. Did you have any sense going into the game that he was capable of something like this soon?
Of a hat-trick in Paris, where we hadn't won since 3 days before I was born. Of course we knew that was going to happen. We've said this before, I don't know whether we've said it in the public thing. I turned up at training and there was this little spotty kid with glasses like the end of Coke bottles. I mean, big fat glasses. And I thought it was somebody. I thought it was just somebody that happened to be around helping with the gear or something. And he was playing pool in the team room. And, you know, coaches are always trying to do things that are a little bit different. And I'm saying, for God's sake, I mean, look, to be realistic here now, he'll get in the way of training.
So hang on.
Until he goes, this is a couple of years before.
Stringer O'Gara, yeah. And now O'Driscoll as well.
I'm a really good gauge of talent.
Talent spotter.
And he turns up to training and he's an unbelievable pain in the arse. I mean, he is just runs down every ball, is faster than everybody, great skills, flicking, everything that you could dream that you'd see. And there's this kid at whatever age he was, 19, able to do all of those things. And yeah, I said, okay, I got that one wrong. I admitted that at least at the end of the first training session. But every time he played afterwards, things got a bit better. And I've said this before, but I remember after that match, and just thinking, you know, kind of thinking quietly about it afterwards, I just said, we have a chance. No, because we hadn't had a superstar, you know, we hadn't had a guy that was just going to set the world alight, and now we had a guy who could score a hat-trick in Paris. That's a kind of cool thing to have in your team.
Can I ask what you were most worried about at that stage of your career before a game? Was it the physicality, the speed of it?
Yeah,
the
physicality.
Right.
Yeah, because I was still 90 kilos, a little over 14 stone. I knew I wasn't from a physique point of view. I still had a lot of growing to do. So
that would have played
it was just surviving
mind.
with right. The big boys.
Okay.
Getting hit, a big shot by a big second rower, a big back rower, and would I survive it? I look back on that game and the three tries at Park, because two of them I was in the right spot at the right time. I ran correct lines. The third one I picked up and ran in, and Emil Intomac obviously had absolutely no interest whatsoever of even making an attempt to tackle. But the other parts of my game, I actually probably had one of my more complete games. If you'd taken them out, I still would have been pretty happy with the performance. So it was the first time in a green jersey, I think, I thought, you know, I can actually stand at this level. Because the first five or six, and even during the World Cup, I remember thinking, I don't know if I'm up to this. I'm only a kid playing with men here.
Yeah.
And then after that night, I vomited on the Champs-Élysées.
Classy.
And so I brought the kid part right back into play.
That was nervousness, yeah?
Yeah. Just the day caught up with me, you know?
Yeah.
John Hayes before games, me after 3.5 bottles of crap wine.
Was it Rob Henderson standing there looking at you?
Yeah, myself and Hendo, yeah. An omelette and chips and a bottle of Plonk.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, I think the eggs were off in the omelette.
Oh. It's a bad pint, I think, is what they say. 5-3-1-6, the text number. If anybody wants to get in touch, you can tweet us here at Off the Ball. Just that France game in 2000, you said 98, it had only been one score. In 99, does Humphreys miss a penalty to win the game? Is that so, like, we're kind of building up to being just as good or to at least believe in?
There was only a couple of points in it. I mean, I remember some of the previous. I was on the bench in 94, which was extraordinary. It was in Parc des Princes. It was just, it was so physical, so rough. It was, like, a lot of the rules or the laws changed in the few years after that, embracing professionalism. Actually, I commentated on the game in 96. It was my first day with the BBC, and it was an it was one of those crazy games where France just went ballistic, totally ballistic again. And when we went to 98, and I remember a couple of the papers had it that they thought this could be the first time in a Five Nations game that a team would be beaten by 100 points. I tell you, that's embarrassing when that's you they're talking about, you know. And I remember the fear that we had inside, and Gatti was coach, and what he had done was he'd got on to a sort of public plea for support, and our team room, and it was a pretty big team room, was just full, wallpapered in good wishes faxes from home, and the whole place was just covered in faxes, which was amazing. And there were some amazing faxes that came in from old people who'd said this is what they look forward to every year, and don't mind the fact that people are thinking that you're rubbish, you'll still have pride in the jersey and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, it was a great link from the fans. We were really feeling beaten down, and we were very close. 18-16, they beat us. So we got very, very close. Then we beat them in 2000 and beat them again back in Lansdowne Road by a point or 2 points the following year.
So why are they able to kill you in 2003? What happens to our team and to their team in between in the World Cup? Because, like, we literally just put in one of our greatest ever World Cup performances again in defeat against Australia up to that point. And, like, it did feel going into that game, this is a really big opportunity for us. This is a French team that we're not going to be scared of. 15, 20 minutes in, 3-0 and the game's over.
I think we got a few things. We got a few things wrong,
yeah.
And we also got them on, I would call it a French day. Not one of the last French days, because they had more of those great French days against New Zealand and World Cups, where every pass hits the hand at the right spot at full tilt. You know, we talked about George Ford's pass and Farrell's pass for Daly's try last week. Every pass they had in the whole game was that sense of perfect. And it was chastening experience again. You know, it's my last game. Thanks for bringing it up. But I hated that fact that we almost reverted to that. And we were nowhere near the mark for that game. Absolutely. And it's hard when you see those days and you come back in again, and it's, I don't know what your thought. It was at the start of your career. I mean, for me, it was just, it left a real huge frustration for me that maybe we'd made a couple of mistakes that we'd made in the past.
I think we did come across a really, really strong French team that day, as you say, that were on their game. I think we got our game plan so wrong, and it's easy retrospectively to look back and see that. We had about three or four different variations on game plans, and this was a relatively new one that we tried, and it was about playing to the 15 and then sweeping down the blind side. I was predominantly the one sweeping, and I was running into a brick wall all day, and I don't think I don't think our attack game was particularly good, but I remember the very first play that we were scored against, we had practiced all week defending it, and yet they still managed to score it. And when those things happen, you go, come on, like, yeah. We've literally been chatting about it all week. It was a crossfield kick from Michalak to Ruggeri, and in they went, and we thought, gosh, you know, if they're going to score against the stuff that we've been chatting about all week, we could be in for a long day here.
You can name names. Who was underneath the kick? Who was which winger of ill repute was it?
I can't remember.
I remember the following week, I was sitting down the waterfront having a glass of wine with Simon Gagan, and thinking, you know, France were playing England in the semi-final of the World Cup. We were having a conversation saying, France, if they play like they did last week, can beat anyone. And there was an absolute thunderstorm that you nearly only get in Australia. Just huge, fast, incredible, floods everything, carnage. And we said, that's the end of that. France have no hope. They'll go out and they'll look at this weather and the balls that they think would stick won't. No, they're gone. And they were rubbish that day. I mean, England wiped the floor with them that day.
Did it ever reach a point in your career where you guys got to a point where you expected to beat France? You thought, we have their number?
Expected, no. I think we always felt that if we played well, that we'd have a great shot. But that more so came in the last few years because France were off colour. They weren't the same French team. You look at the one where we won our first championship, actually my final game, you know, they weren't a good French side and they still should have beaten us. They missed a sitter in front of the post. Doucin missed a kick. So we shouldn't have won that one. We got a draw over there, but you have to look at that too. We won in 2000 in Stade de France. We didn't win there again until 2014.
Yeah.
Like, that's a long time to wait. We got a draw somewhere in between. But even a bad French team, such is their quality, particularly over there, most of the time had our number.
Do we overestimate how much of a ramshackle they are from a tactical point of view? Like, that's thrown at them all the time now.
Well, just because of the coaches they've had over the last few years,
yeah.
I think it's been very un-French, their style. I think you look back to the French teams of the 80s and 90s and the brand they played, and it played to their strengths because it was, you know, the shackles were off and you were allowed to do what you wanted. I think they were a lot more structured, particularly under Philippe Saint-André. I think he went back to an English style of kicking the ball an awful lot, trying to set up for drop goals, a bit of a negative style. Right. Whereas I think you can see in this French team under Guy Novès, I still think that they are struggling with a little bit of direction and a coach that had more of an idea as to how to get the most out of the sum of their parts would do a better job, but they are encouraged to play an awful lot more. We're seeing a bit of that Toulouse style of throwing the 50-50 pass, good lines of running, you know, trying to get the crowd on side again by playing with a freedom and an opportunity to impress them to get them behind you. So I think we're seeing aspects of them that are brilliant, but I think the looseness of their offloading as well is going to hurt them against better sides.
We'll definitely preview the game in a bit more detail a little bit later on. But look who's here, ladies and gentlemen. Who's on our big green chair? Look at the camera there. Good evening. Welcome.
Jar.
You'd swear you had some distance to travel today.
I did, actually.
You've been getting slaughtered in your absence. I don't know if you were listening to us in the taxi on the way.
I've been told I usually speak slowly, but after hearing that radio, I'm reflecting whether I go hard and cut the bollocks out of the two of them. Or do I just take my bait? And because after that, I think there's not much of a comeback. Jesus, that was harsh.
Cut the bollocks out of the two of them, I think, that's what we want, right?
Oh, I'd love it. I would love it.
But the whole point of the green chair is that everybody who's coming in is...
Yeah, this is quite strange, actually.
Yeah, we'll bring you up on stage after the ads. But everybody in the room was given the opportunity to sit in the green chair and tell a story, and the best two are going to be up for the quiz a little bit later on. So if you do have a story, feel free to unburden yourself about either of our colleagues here. This is the most... We've been talking about nerves. This is the most nervous I've seen them in a long time.
No, I'm not nervous. Not at a far from it. I'm actually enjoying it. I can't wait.
I met the lads.
I'll just come in. I'll come in with two quick ones, okay? The bits I retained were Brian felt he was defending at 12 an awful lot. Drico, the wheels were gone at that stage. That's why you were in at 12. And... The only thing about Woody, I don't know, there's fucking no one here over 60, Woody. No one remembers when you played, so shut the fuck up.
Raj. The wheels might have been gone early, but I still had enough in the tank in 09 when you threw that intercept. And I was able to just slap it into third gear and coast in.
Listen. It's the same as the first man to go to Everest. No one ever remembers who followed. Just remember who got there first.
All right.
It's easy when the path is well worn at that stage. With three other teams in Ireland done, so... Well, there was railings on both sides to help you get up. I know what your comeback is. You have three of them.
You can just keep going. I'm happy enough here. The floor is yours. This has worked out really well for us, it turns out, just to build that little bit of tension. It seems like we've got an insight into what the Irish dressing room might have been like. But we are going to have to take a quick break. We're here with Heineken. With thanks to the Heineken Rugby Club, which allows fans to get more from the game. If you sign up, you'll get exclusive benefits, match tickets, exclusive event invites, discounts from Ireland's top brands, and more. Join HeinekenRugbyClub.com. There is more magic to come after the break.
Off the Ball.
Home of Wednesday night rugby with Woody and Jerry.
On News Talk 106 to 108.
Hello, the Olympia! No, that's bullshit. Hello, the Olympia! Hello, up top! Hey, yeah, yeah. They were the ones who were too late to get good seats, so they're up top. I can't even see us. Ronan, good evening.
Hi, Ger.
We're live.
My apologies. I thought I was in the changing room there for the first bit of that.
That's all right. It was perfect.
Didn't happen. It wasn't me.
Because you've been listening to us on the radio, so you know you're on the radio.
Yeah, it's kind of hard when you're being picked on and you end up retaliating like that. Oh, yes. I love it. I'm getting an awe in Dublin. That must be a first.
So, all animosity aside for a couple of minutes at least, when did you two actually first become aware of each other? When did you start playing together for Ireland teams? Was there any underage stuff, or was it actually just when you reached the Ireland senior team?
I had heard about him, because when I started in with Con, I'd say it would have been 98, and you train Tuesday and Thursday nights, the game is completely different, obviously, but... I can remember leaving a training session. It's a weird memory to have, but just walking on the second pitch back up to the changing rooms, and there was talk that this guy O'Driscoll could be dropped for the Irish under-20s or maybe under-21s, but he was meant to be the best thing we've ever seen. And that was the time that I kind of just, that name stuck with me. But no, I didn't have any involvement underage of Brian. I kind of, for the 99 World Cup, I was number kind of 31. So I was with the Irish team quite a lot. So that was an unbelievable experience. And I got to know him then. And he was really humble back then and a really nice guy. He had normal hair. He didn't dye it. He remained as he was, an absolute beaut, and he was the one fella that I just had an instant attraction to, and it was brilliant.
Yeah. So, how quickly did you feel like you were at a level? Because there's a period in the mid-2000s where it's your team, like. You guys are the senior players, you're kind of running the whole thing.
And I'm sure there's a lot before that. Like, to get to senior player with your country, it's a long, long time, you know. I don't think it's like that, because I had David Humphreys, who was, for people who know him, was a model pro, was an unbelievable senior player, was a great mentor, role model. So in that regard, for your first 2-3 years when you're there, you don't really open your mouth, you watch.
But he's already a senior player in a way.
Obviously Brian was different to everyone else because he was guaranteed his place, you know.
When did you see the changing of the guard from your point of view? Was it that, surely it was before the 0-3 quarterfinal when you came on, and or not quarterfinal, the one against Argentina that basically dug us out of a hole and got us into that into the quarterfinal? Was that the first time that you fully felt like a senior player?
Yeah, it was, because I remember it was something that was strange. Like, the first 15 were allowed to come home after the Australia tour, and I wasn't, I suppose, nailed on to start, so I wanted to go on to tour Tonga and Samoa to play good games to make sure I trying to get in the summer before that, and that was an unbelievable experience, and I think that gave me a bit of confidence. And then as you know, like Hump said, vital contributions over the years, so in that regard it was I suppose it was just a gradual process.
Brian, what was your first impression of him?
He had these shoulder pads on him that, you know, wouldn't have been out of place in the 80s. He was a pretty skinny guy back in those days. Roger worked hard at putting on any weight. He wasn't someone that easily put it on, but he was particularly slight back then. I think what stood out was this real underlying confidence and belief in his own ability. I think that filtered out throughout the whole team, particularly when he came into the side. Obviously, he'd been in training sessions, missed out in the 99 World Cup.
Yeah.
Very unlucky not to be the third choice. I think we only brought 2 tens.
Yeah.
And then I remember he was going to be playing in the massacre over in Twickenham in 2000, but had to pull out injured. It was the best move you ever made.
Can I put something to you from 2000, that camp? Because he goes in against Scotland, something that you said in your book. So he looks at you and thinks you're very confident. And you say at the time of that 2000 Six Nations campaign, people looked at me during the week in camp. They probably thought I didn't have a care in the world, that nothing fazed me. A lot of that was a mask. With me, confidence and insecurity sat side by side. So it seemed like you were strutting around and the others were buying the act.
But you've done nothing, you know. I think you get confidence from, I suppose, having good performances in the bag. But at that stage, you're telling yourself you can do it, but you haven't done it. So when a crisis or a rocky patch hits you, what do you go back to? In my case, nothing. So, I think a lot of people don't get it, and I still don't get it. I think it was probably the fact that I chose the goal kick because I loved the responsibility, but it was like an unbelievable weight in the fact that, you know what I mean, your main rival is Wilkinson, who kind of did it pretty well. So, like, that's what you're measured at. So it was just, for me, the 2001 Lions Tour was the biggest eye-opener ever. Just in terms of, we were, I think, extremely lucky, that batch of Irish players that went on that, to see 24 months later that core of the Lions team winning the World Cup with England. It was just it was scary how far ahead they were. I was rooming with Rob Holy, and I can remember he and a was kind of, he was probably, I don't know, 10 or 8 years older than me, world-class player. I was a rookie out half, rooming with him. I kind of whipped into my baggy boxers, whipped over the cover straight into bed, and your man was in his kind of Speedo briefs, and he had about a 10-pack. Like that, I was like, Jesus, is he playing the same sport as I'm playing? So it was like the toasted special and chips at night were finished. It was a lovely protein shake for the next 10 years.
Having Wilkinson as a rival, like, would you have driven yourself anyway to do the things you did if you didn't have Johnny Wilkinson there? Like, 'cause it seems to me that it's great that you have him, and it's brilliant to see the examples of this, but I also feel like you guys were pretty driven internally that, you know, going on the Lions tour, you see the example of somebody else, but actually you kind of knew what you had to be doing and you wanted to get there anyway. That,
yeah,
you were ready
love,
for it.
You'd love if it was, if that was there maybe before you, you know what I mean? You'd love, the bit of me now, I don't think about it that much, but you'd love to have had a crack off playing under Schmidt or someone like that, you know, in that kind of way. You'd love... You're always asking what would that have been like, because going back to my point earlier, when you're, I suppose, setting the pace and you're one of the leaders in the group, you'd love sometimes to be a sheep and have, you know what I mean, 7 or 8 Roy Keanes in your team and them driving it for you. But that's the way it worked out.
I think you can look on that both ways, where the early disappointments and learning a lot fuels the fire for the later successes. And I suppose because that's how it panned out, that's the way I look on it. Do I look back at times and wish I was more professional in the first 7 or 8 years of my career? Of course. You look at the level of professionalism now and it's like we're playing a different sport.
Yeah,
you might. And you wonder, you know, we had a lot of talent, particularly provincially in those early years, but we didn't have the right mentality and didn't have the right work ethic. They did, and they kept knocking on the door and eventually got let in after a couple of close disappointments. It took us an awful lot longer at Leinster for the penny to drop on that. And thankfully, it wasn't too late. But you do look back and wonder about missed opportunities as well. I think the worst thing that ever happened to us was beating them in the Celtic Cup final in 2000, because we thought we were the finished article. Being able to win with 14 men, and we celebrated it for the rest of the season and thought that talent would just carry us through, and just shows talent only can carry so far. The work ethic is a massive component, and the sacrifice, and it took a few years for that realisation really to sink in.
You mentioned that Lions tour in 2001, and I'm glad you did, because we wanted to put something to bed here. Twice at these roadshows in the past, we've had Brian and Keith would describe an incident that happened on that Lions tour where allegedly Austin Healey had the head poked off him by Brian O'Driscoll. So they both told this story, and it got printed and it went all around the world, and it ends up in Austin Healey's Twitter account. And he says, never happened, after dinner story. You're a central character in this, because Austin Healey is, like the two lads were tonight, picking on you at the start of this story. Apparently he's like got boxing gloves on, he's like punching you in the face going, weeks after Donald McRae has done exactly the same thing. Not Donald, that's the writer. It is Donald.
Duncan
McRae. Is this true? Is this what happens?
In the Austin Healey Brian case?
Yeah.
Brian boxed that off him. It's black and white, but there were... I think there was more of a fun element to it too, though. It was kind of, he didn't really think it was happening, but all of a sudden... You have to be a little bit with your teammates, even though you're boxing the head off him. Yeah, it did happen, black and white.
Yeah.
Case closed.
And he was defending your honour, is that what happened?
To be fair, if you know Austin Healey, I think he could be up for 10 things a day. But like, he is actually great crack on a tour, but he's just mischievous. He's always at something, so he was going to get his bait, and then he got it quite early.
On that note, there's a text in. Austin Healey gets punched in the head at the bottom of a ruck. Toulouse are playing Leinster. Nigel Owens is the referee and calls in Martin Johnson and Trevor Brennan and asks, "Who threw the punch, lads?" Martin Johnson replies, "Could have been any one of 29, sir." I don't know if it's true, but it's a good story. In fairness, though, in 2000, there's a picture of Top Astronomer Nagara, and just for the listeners at home, there's also the hair's just grown out. You've got roots there, Brian. Is this like the end of the phase, or had you just not had your do done?
Yeah, Shay wasn't around at that time, so I only ever went to Shay for it. I was looking to copy Roger's mushroom head at that stage, so I was just in the growth phase.
It's a classic, though. You haven't changed it since, Roger.
No.
Hey, you know,
George. Easy now, easy now.
The night is young. In fairness, though, in 2005 on the Lions Tour, Brian's gone through a pretty bad time, but you're one of the players who were there for him after all the shit goes down against New Zealand. Like, there's a proper bond between you guys, and it's kind of in these instances where you do actually stand up for each other that on the rugby field and off it.
That is exactly, I suppose, the most pleasing thing of the last 15 years of the guys I played with, and everyone thinks their generation is great, and, you know what I mean, I agree with that. They're entitled to their own views, but I think you look at the guys that we interlapped with, you'll never get them again. There's absolutely no doubt about it, especially, the likes of Trevor Brennan, Claw, Golliff, Hayes, Wally, Quinney, Leamy. It's not right to kind of mention them because it was just... it was such crack we had, but such playing for each other, and I think that's such a valuable tool or asset that other countries don't have, especially at test level. You look at the French team playing on Saturday, there wouldn't be a bond there that exists between Irish people, and that's, I suppose, the most pleasing thing that I took out of my career, I'd say, was the friendship with Brian, because I shared absolutely everything with him. He was the one fella that was just so open and honest, and yeah, we did have direct conversations, but it was always what's best for the team, and you can be sure at the end, all right, he pushed Johnny forward, I'd say, but... but that's... Like, you have to be... There would be other fellas that play test rugby be thinking, like, the team has been held back if I'm not being picked. But, like, it became a case where, yes, that was best for the team, you know what I mean? But, if you are playing sport at a world-class level, that's what you need. And that's, I think, the time I played, it was just... I just feel so, privileged. It was such a great bunch of people, and he was the captain, and obviously the two drivers were himself and Paul.
Was there ever a period where Munster-Leinster cliques were a team?
I'd say everyone bar the two of us.
Really?
I would think so.
Because I've heard.
And maybe I'd say there was times when I'd say I was kind of. I probably said to myself quietly, "Is he playing mind games with me or not?" But that would be the respect I have. But he was the one guy that I'd say that was, for me anyway, that was just he rose above that because of.
Because I was reading one of your books this morning.
One of my books. I don't have all.
That was another sly dig in the fuck on the way in as well.
Roger's third autobiography.
Spring 2018.
But your Munster teammates would slag you, you know, that you secretly wanted to play with Leinster because you were very open to being friends with them in Ireland camp.
Yeah, well, you have to be, you know. I think but there's two sides. But A, they were good guys, and B, if you're the old half, you kind of have to conduct between the forwards and the backs, and all the backs were from Leinster. Yeah. So, like, it made sense to get on with them, didn't it?
And did there come a point, can you pinpoint a time where everybody took that attitude?
No, because I think, Joe, the big thing is that it's such a team game, yet it's so individualised that everyone has their own individual goals, and some fella, you have no idea how he's feeling in terms of, is he lacking confidence, is he on top of his game, does he have other issues that are worrying him? So, like, to succeed a test, to play year in, year out, you have to be extremely selfish. That's the bottom line. So you've got to make sure you're performing, and then B, you earn the right to talk, and then hopefully your team is performing. But like, if your house is in order, you'd want to keep quiet, you know. And that was really, I think, the way that the past generation passed it on. You earned the right to talk. So at first, you kind of performance, and then other people were never spoken. When they did speak, it was like, Jesus, that's so good. Give us more of that, you know.
Right. There was a proper dislike between the two teams at provincial level, which ultimately, in retrospect, I think really is important because it drives the team to reach greater heights. Like, no one ever wants to take a backward step.
It's 100% right. You need that. It has to be like that.
It's a bit friendly now, right?
No, I wouldn't think so, because it seems I think fringe players can move, but I don't think any hardcore players can move between the provinces, because it's just not right, you know what I mean? The fellas are from Cork or Limerick or Tipperary, and they're fellas from Sandy Mount, and
I keep going. Where are you staying tonight?
And Dorky and Killiney and Barnhall. And so that's their identity. I think that's really, really crucial. That.
What are you thinking in that photo?
I haven't a hope of getting them, but it's just, I wish I hid. The one time when it's not going for you, it's not going for you. That was a day when it didn't go for you, but you got to take your bait, and you know, at times you just got to keep going for 80 minutes. It's not good enough, but there are times when it's not going for you and the wheel will turn, and you got to keep convincing yourself that next ball, and something then cracks. Usually when you're at your lowest ebb, you get a good break, and that applies for life as well as rugby. So I think in that regard thank you. I don't know, if he was a Fijian, the ball could have popped out. That's the only... it was just...
For listeners at home, it's 0-9 in Croke Park and you're running away.
Yeah, listen, we were low going in there and no one gave us a chance in that semi-final, and I suppose rightly so, because we'd been beaten out the gate twice that season by them. They were the reigning European champions. They'd won it two times.
No tries in the two league games over 180 minutes. No tries for Leinster.
And it's incredible what playing scared can do to you. And playing with a focus that... It was a bloody-mindedness that there was nowhere to go if we succumbed in that game. And it wasn't even necessarily about the result. It was about just doing ourselves justice with the performance. And if they outplayed that, well, so be it. But we just couldn't... We couldn't not perform on that day.
Did any part of you think he texted me before the semi-final in 06 and didn't text me that morning? What game is he playing?
No, you get a few more texts over a three-year period, Joe.
No. Well, it had struck you as quite striking that he texted you the morning of the 06 semi-final.
No, because I suppose it's... I was extremely close to him, so I wouldn't... I could have got a text at any day about anything from him, or vice versa, so that wouldn't have been any reflection on it. And the fact that he was just cool as a breeze about games, he was wrecked my head.
Yeah. I think that was the thing which struck you more, that he was that relaxed in 06.
Yeah, it was just like, it was so angry when the fact that you just look at him behind you and he's just smiling and laughing at people on the way to games. I was just like, what is this guy doing? But he produced, so that's all that matters.
Did you ever get to a point where you didn't feel somewhat tortured in the 24 hours before a big game?
No, at the end I said to myself, I've got to enjoy this. I think when you have kids, you kind of play for other people as opposed to yourself, and I think that was important. But I suppose I was extremely lucky, Joe, in the fact that I played for so long. I prepared well to play for Ireland, but I took the goal kicking, and accumulating points and scores hugely seriously after, I suppose, going up at the same time with Carter and Wilkinson were the two tens, yeah. You know. So I felt that, as you know, I'm a proud Corkman, and I got massive enjoyment out of playing for Munster and playing for Ireland, because it's, you know, I mean, you're a rugby player that prepares well, but you're like anyone here, taken from the crowd at 18 with a bit of potential, and you work hard and you go to reach your dreams. And that's what it was like for me.
When you first started getting a look in with Ireland, you might on a Friday be checking teletext to see if Humphreys had done something spectacular for Ulster and worried he'd played brilliantly. And then there's a period where you're not directly challenged, and then Sexton comes along and it's a rivalry again. Just, you know, you're talking about the worry and the stress and the angst over the big games, and I presume it's the same for a rival. Does it do you any good? Were you better and sharper when you were worried about Humphreys and Sexton, or did you maybe play a bit better when you didn't have that immediate worry?
I think you have stages for that. I think you you learn how to deal with it, like, because Ulster usually played on a Friday night, so we'd meet on a Friday night, and kind of the one, I suppose, Ulster would have a few players in potential, I suppose, mixed to play for Ireland, so... I can remember one Friday night, just and all the lads in the Munster team getting such a kick out of their humps, got 32 points, you know. It's just like, you have no chance of playing. Well, like, what are they to say? Oh, you're all right, Rod, you'll be grand, you'll get in. Sure you will. You know, so it's... after a while, it wasn't from reading or psychology or anything. You just concentrate on yourself.
Right.
And I think, but you know what I mean? There was definitely periods that your mood is influenced by the papers, by what people say, and by how other people are playing. But it takes you a while to get over the fact that it's you control what you can control.
Mm.
But that's easier said than done.
Yeah, there's some breaking sports news tonight. Claudio Ranieri's been fired as the manager of Leicester. It's sad, isn't it? I don't know. Maybe it's not. Whoa, we're live on the radio. That guy swore. Get him out. 53106, the text number if anybody wants to get in touch. Look, there's a couple of other things we want to talk to you about. The 2009 Lions tour was something that we wanted to talk about. We were watching the final few minutes of that second test again today. And the Sean Edwards commentary on the sideline, have you seen that video? Where he's like, kick it out, kick it out, kick it out. Myself and Joe were having a debate today. I think if you kick that out, you're settling for a draw and you can't win the test series.
It didn't ever come into my head to kick it out, ever, or even afterwards, and I've taken all the points on board. Go on, sorry.
Where was your kick chase? You know, I think that's something that wasn't ever really in his defence. That was never really mentioned.
Tommy Blower runs the wrong direction.
He went and chased his own kick, and you shouldn't have to do that. You know, to obviously focus on a kick, you're going to be static afterwards, but then to have the wherewithal to go after it because you realise no one else is.
Yeah.
And these things happen, and it was an easy scapegoat, easy to pick on.
If
on
anybody
someone
forgets, the Lions were miles ahead at one point in the game.
Yeah,
like
we listened. It was far from. I made a terrible read after I had my big collision with Danny Rousseau. I made a terrible read on the next scrum. Habana went in, scored a try. I went off after that because I couldn't decipher who was who properly. So you lose both centres and both props. You know, your team is going to be struggling. You're going to be in reverse. And we were, the 80 minutes couldn't come quick enough. And it, just the manner in which it happened at the end. You know, when someone concedes the penalty, it's easy to point the finger at them. The damage was done long before that.
That's to lose the game, though. Like, is a draw in Test series, is that, it's okay? Like, because I remember we've talked about the New Zealand game before.
No, it's about winning, I think, you know.
Yeah.
The damage was done in the first test, in the first 40 minutes. We were very poor, you know. Like, it wasn't, 2005 is... New Zealand's a different kettle of fish, but in South Africa you could have ambitions of winning those games, you know.
How groggy were you in terms of your... Because you'd had two bad hits, or certainly one bad hit. But were you thinking straight, looking back at it?
I was.
Right.
But I just... Spies is a powerful unit, so he bowled me over. Mind you, you didn't have to be that powerful. and the 13... Brian, what's...
Jack Furry.
Yeah, it was a, he's a unit too.
Yeah,
you know what
he,
I mean?
Is, and he I, is junky.
Made a good old thing off of it. He was... but yeah, it was the kick chase that was annoying because I kind of called Tommy and I said, right, I was expecting him to go for it, but he just gave me a serious 50. Yours! but the other thing too, it was an incredible kick from Marne Steyn. Yeah. That was his debut, I think.
Mm. Halfway line.
53. Yeah. I can remember it well, don't believe me. Just there, please miss. Fucking please miss this. Swallow me up.
There's a shot in the dressing room afterwards and you're sitting beside Shane Williams and you're just staring at the ground and it's the heaviest silence I think I've seen in any of these behind the scenes documentaries. I can't even imagine what you're thinking. Like, do you get up and apologise? Do you criticise the kick chase? Do you say nothing?
No, I'd say I don't recall, but it's as low as you could possibly be.
Mm. Were you concussed?
It's irrelevant. I don't know, and
but
I
it's
think
possible.
It's pardon.
It's possible because yeah, you were down on the ground for ages, and then you get up and you get back into the line.
Of course you do. Yeah, but like whether you're concussed or not is you still messed up. So
yeah.
It doesn't. You know what I mean? You got to live with yourself with that.
Yeah,
and that was an extremely rough week. That was, you know what I mean? Because that's as big as it gets, and that's a catastrophic error, you know?
Yeah, but it was only to draw the game. You weren't going to win it, is the thing. Like, that's the other thing. It's a catastrophic. But, like, the whole point
is... You know what? The way we were, too, though, if you were 10 points up and you did it, you'd be annoyed with yourself, you
sure.
know? It would, but it's just... It's leaving down teammates, leaving down your own standards. It's just...
What are teammates like in that situation? Or can you remember... I remember O'Connell walking off after you,
making a point. It was a big moment for him because he was getting a lot of abuse from the British press and they were going after him in that tour, and it would have been fantastic for him if he was able to captain...
winning series.
You know?
Win a match. Do other teammates come up to you and say, don't worry about it?
All the Irish lads would be straight up. A lot of the other fellas that you become friendly would have too, but... Joe, you know what I mean? You just, it's the same as everything. You got to take your medicine.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It's,
it's on you, it feels
like. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the law of the jungle when you play at that level. You know what I mean? You got to, it was the best thing that Woody told me after, remember the tour in down in, where did we play with that pig Adidas ball? Is it Dunedin?
Yeah.
And I think.
2002.
That's what it was officially called. It was a new ball introduced, but there was icicles on the ball. It was so cold, and we had a chance to beat New Zealand down there, and I think I kicked maybe 1 out of 4 or 2 out of 4, and I missed kicks that I should have gotten. Ireland would have won, and I can remember going on holiday and walking the pier for about a week because I just couldn't sit still because my head was going overtime, and Woody was just said, you got to take learnings from this. If you brush it under the carpet, it'll come back to bite you again. And it was great advice, you know what I mean? So every massive failure is an opportunity to learn or grow. And it was great in terms of, obviously, you prefer not to be doing an Alliance Test Series. But you got to take a positive out of it.
Yeah, This is the stuff that's going to make him a good coach, right?
Yeah, exactly. What about that Grand Slam? That was half decent, huh?
Yeah, and that was...
Come on, even you can be just happy about that one, for God's sake.
Jeez, no, I am very happy, believe me.
I was talking to Peter Stringer a while back and he said he didn't throw you a good pass and you would let him know about it. Is that
at
right?
At that moment?
Yeah, is that fair? Is that right?
He's talking through his arse. right. No, I think...
It was a bit inside shoulder.
I think it just shows basically there's someone looking after you because 99 times out of 100 that ball shouldn't go over. you look at the ball drop, it's the biggest a kind of miss hit, but it just shows, I suppose, if your body shape is correct, the ball will go where you want it to go, but the strike is...
You intentionally, though, had to scoop or feel as
though...
Yeah,
I just had to get it really quickly, though.
Yeah, but got high trajectory because you thought they were right
on
you.
I just knew... Sorry. I just knew that
for listeners,
I could
Rogers
see...
kicked.
Was right it front. Ryan Jones and Nugget were coming hard, so it was just a case of get the ball to foot as quickly as possible because... you know yourself from watching Johnny drop the ball 1, 2, 3. That doesn't happen at some stages. So your technique goes out the window. You got to get a strike in this, you know. But it was the same thing. I can remember the morning of that game. It was because the Grand Slam hadn't been done, I suppose, from before the time some Woody played. No one knew what it was like. So it was kind of...
What do we do?
A little bit of that. On the morning of it, I think we were very relaxed. But I suppose if we knew what the reaction of the people would be, you would have kind of been a lot more uptight about it, you know?
Yeah, maybe it was good that you didn't know. We've loads more to talk about. They're pretty happy memories, and we are going to get Roland to actually demonstrate that drop goal kicking action for us. You didn't even notice those goalposts. You thought they were just for show. But a little bit later on, we're going to do that. So we are here with thanks to Heineken Rugby Club, which allows fans to get more from the game. If you sign up, you'll get exclusive benefits such as match tickets, exclusive event invites, discounts with Ireland's top brands, and more. Join at HeinekenRugbyClub.com. We're going to talk to Donegal Callaghan next.
Off the ball.
Get all the best bits at newstalk.com/offtheball.
Newstalk 106 to 108.